for me, as a political historian, when I hear people say, this isn't who we are, you know, we don't know what this is about, I would respectfully disagree.
Today on the podcast, bracing for the possibility of more violence after the unprecedented attack on the U.S. Capitol. Hey, it's Jeff Tiberi. President Trump has just a handful of days left in office, but it's unlikely that they'll be uneventful. Even though the outgoing leader has been pretty quiet since losing his Twitter privileges, there is a lot in motion surrounding Trump's role in last week's insurrection. Talk of impeachment is swirling around the halls of Congress for a second time, as is removal from office with an assist from Vice President Mike Pence and the utilization of the 25th Amendment. Meanwhile, the FBI is working through a list of wanted suspects who gleefully took part in the insurrection that left at least 5 people dead. Who among us here in America thought we'd live to see the day when violent extremists would enact an assault on their own nation's government?
Any careful look at the long arc of history here and how white supremacy has worked, particularly in response to displays of expansions of political power and expansions of citizenship to marginalized communities. You know, this type of repressive backlash that we're seeing in 2021, we've seen this before.
Deandra Rose does not strike me as the type to take any pleasure in saying, I told you so. But the Duke University political science and public policy professor knows well that long arc of American history, which helped her see that this was coming on some level. Her understanding of how the events of January 6th played out is helped by a deep understanding of another period of violence more than a century earlier. The only successful insurrection of a sitting government in our nation's history. It happened in Wilmington, North Carolina in 1898, and it goes by many names. The Wilmington Massacre, the Wilmington Riot, the Wilmington Coup.
So it's interesting to note that Wilmington in 1898 was North Carolina's largest city. It was a majority black city. It was really this powerful representation of what the New South could look like and did look like after the Civil War in the Reconstruction era, actually toward the end of that Reconstruction period. And so what did it look like? It had, you know, black Americans, white Americans who were in positions of authority, black-owned stores, and the newspaper. There was a black-owned newspaper. There were elected officials, you know, throughout the state who were African American, members of the North Carolina General Assembly. And, you know, a lot of this was the result of what is known as the fusion government. And so there is this period where, you know, Republicans in North Carolina were really tired of losing elections to Southern Democrats. And so they decided to form a coalition with the populists, who were largely farmers. And they decided to actually align their interests. You know, the Republicans included black Americans at that time overwhelmingly, as well as, you know, the farmers who were associated with the populists. And they decided to pool their interests, and they had massive success at the state level in the 1896 and 1894 elections. The Southern Democrats, as you might imagine, did not like that, and so they decided that they were going to very carefully develop a strategy to take back the state. And so what did that strategy look like? It looked like, you know, a number of leaders working to consolidate the white vote and to intimidate black voters throughout the state, and to move the sort of interracial governing system at the time in places like, well, in Wilmington in particular, out of power.
Remember the newspaper she mentioned. It'll be important later. First, a Cliff Notes history lesson on what helped fuel the Wilmington coup. After the Civil War, remember, it was the Republicans and the party of Lincoln who were anti-slavery abolitionists. Reconstruction was, for a time, working, and there was black representation in the halls of government. In the early 1890s, black Republicans, as well as progressives, formed a new alliance with fed-up farmers. Poor whites, growers from the mountains, were the catalyst for the Populist Party. And that group joined, or fused, with the Republicans to create the Fusion Coalition. Bonded by some common obstacles, the factions called for universal public education, equal voting rights, and a more progressive tax structure. The fusion movement saw great gains throughout the South during the decade. But Democrats, led by white working farmers, fought back, literally, using racist cartoons, fear-mongering editorials, and the most aggressive of tactics. They sought to win at the ballot box. When that goal seemed out of reach, they went another route. Insurrection. In 1898, Wilmington was the state's largest city, where economic vibrancy and progress for the black community were on full display. White Democrats sought to tear it down.
White supremacists really used the media, they used appeals to white power and this idea that white power needed to be preserved at all costs to make the case that something had to change in the next election. And so by the time the 1898 election rolled around, you know, it was a sham. The black participants and their allies, the members of that fusion government, you know, really tended to stand down in a way that they hadn't in the previous electoral competitions. And so, you know, we saw in fact this group known as the Red Shirts. And they actually attacked black voters and worked to really stop them from making their way to the polls. So then we saw, you know, these resounding victories for the Southern Democrats in 1898. But that wasn't enough. You know, right after that election, they came up with a white Declaration of Independence, and they had a number of items that they were committed to. You know, number one, they were going to tamp down black rule and really change that. In government institutions, they were going to promote white economic well-being and white employment, and they were going to expel the black owner of the local newspaper in Wilmington within 24 hours.
And here's where dirty politics turned deadly. The owner of that paper was Alexander Manley. The next day, an armed mob of about 200 white men set out to find him and run him out of town. Problem was,
Alexander Manley had actually already fled Wilmington at that point.
But mobs like that don't tend to just head home once they're riled up.
By that time, there was some energy and some momentum that was growing up around this uprising, and soon there were 2,000 white men, and you know, who were really launching an attack on the society and the population in Wilmington. And so, what did that look like? There was this marching of black elected officials and their white allies, you know, any people who had supported this fusionist form of government, to the train station, and they said, "Look, you need to make your way out of Wilmington, or there could be, you know, there will be fatal consequences." There were hundreds, possibly, who were massacred.
Deandra Rose says she made it through elementary school, middle school, high school, college, and grad school without ever hearing about the insurrection in Wilmington in 1898. Today, that history is a part of what she teaches her students at Duke, most of whom join her class without any prior knowledge of it.
You know, the records were intentionally, records weren't well kept. And in fact, the history was really doctored to emphasize, you know, the white victories in that election. In fact, the members of the Wilmington, the mayor and the aldermen were actually, who had been democratically elected and who had not been up for election or for re-election in 1898. So their seats had been safe. That mob actually compelled them to, quote unquote, resign from office. And they were each replaced with one of the supremacist participants in the uprising. You know, thus, it really was truly the first successful coup d'etat in U.S. history. And, you know, when you put the insurrectionists in power, they have the capacity to rewrite the history and to really shape what is commemorated.
Insurrectionists were successful in 1898. Then, 2 years later, a couple of the leading figures made great political gains. Charles Aycock was elected governor, and in a twist of irony, the longtime proponent of public education would help to enact the fusionist platform goal of free schools for whites and blacks. And then there was Furnifold Simmons, another organizer of the massacre. He was elected to the U.S. Senate, where he would serve 5 terms. Which brings us back to Capitol Hill. So far in 2021, the government has not been overtaken. But I do wonder, how will this moment be remembered in history?
You know, that remains to be seen. For many years in political science, you know, we think very carefully about just sort of the significance of recency in voter decisions and the significance of the economy. And of course, we see that those two factors, you know, play a really important role. I think we saw that they played important roles in this recent election, especially as COVID-19 and economic upheaval continue to be something that we are grappling with. But I think that this was different. You know, January 6th hit differently for those of us who are observing the political landscape. And I do think that we'll have, I hope that we'll have a longer memory for what happened recently. And I hope that as the media covers this, as professors, you know, teach about this, as we remember this moment, we remember what led up to it and the fact that this was not entirely surprising. If you look at the entire month between Election Day and January 6th, there were these steady, there was this steady commentary from the president about how, look, you know, we're not going to have a country if we're not willing to fight for it. You know, if you want to fight for your country, you're going to have to show some strength. You have to be strong. You know, a lot of that type of rhetoric, you know, that sort of inciting, like, hey, you know, this is the time to show up and, you know, show how far you're willing to go to win. I mean, those types of appeals said a lot. And I think if anything, we've learned that we ought to pay attention to what our lawmakers are saying, what our leaders are saying, and not just write things off.
Is there an element of policy that could help in preventing this, fixing this, deterring this, whatever? Is there a public policy fix for preventing these kinds of incidents moving forward?
I think that impeachment is really, is one of them. You know, this would be an action that lawmakers could take that would signal how seriously they take this. And they will signal that this is a no-go for lawmakers, that if you want the privilege of representing, you know, your fellow citizens in the halls of political power, that there are some things that you just do not do, and that nobody is above the law. And so I think in 1898, we clearly saw that there were a number of white citizens who felt that they were above the law. And in the aftermath of their heinous actions, demonstrated that they were indeed above the law. And, you know, I think that lawmakers today have a responsibility as representatives in a democracy to make sure that they make it very clear that no one is above the law.
So I want to transition a little bit and ask you about North Carolina's congressional delegation, because after this played out on Wednesday, 7 of the 8 Republicans in the U.S. House from North Carolina ultimately sustained their objections, voting against the election certification, the duly legally held election in which Joe Biden beat President Trump. I'm wondering what your reaction was to ultimately finding out that 7 of the 8, despite everything that played out, still voted to uphold those objections.
You know, sadly, I'm not surprised. And perhaps that's because political science theory suggests that oftentimes when lawmakers sense that, you know, there might be some redistribution of political power, they might dig their heels in ways that will help to preserve the status quo. And I think that those who are in office, you know, I'm thinking of those who actually, you know, went against a democratically conducted and concluded election to try to take a stand to align themselves with the president, you know, they were really looking out for their own individual political stakes and political futures. And I think what's concerning is that we're in a political moment where that might actually work for them. So the big question is what the consequence of that decision will be. And so on one hand, you know, you might see that the Republican Party launches, you know, or supports primary opposition to those representatives who are in very safe districts, you know, or we might see that their erstwhile supporters really do change in terms of their support or their willingness to support those candidates or those representatives. But I think that's a really big question, is where do we draw the line as citizens? Where does party trump country for those of us who are acting in a very intense partisan era? I don't discount the significance of partisanship in shaping who has access to political power. So for some representatives, it is just that kind of partisan appeal or just that kind of alignment with the president that gave them the opportunity to go to Congress in the first place. And so they're trying to stay in the game.
There were three Republicans from North Carolina who didn't vote to object to the election certification of the Biden over Trump victory. They were Republican U.S. Senators Tom Tillis, who just won re-election to another six-year term, Republican U.S. Senator Richard Burr, who's retiring, and U.S. House Member Patrick McHenry. For whatever it's worth, my thought is that Patrick McHenry, who at one point was the number four Republican in the U.S. House, would like to be Speaker one day, and I think he's trying to keep his head out of the fray. But what's different about those three? Why did those? Is there anything I'm missing here? Why didn't they vote to object?
You know, I wish I had a solid answer for you there, Jeff. I think that it's really thinking in terms of the future and thinking about their legacies. And I suspect that in the Senate, you know, seeing people like Kelly Loeffler also, you know, change her position on the certification of President Biden's victory, Vice President-elect Harris's victory, I think that after the violence, the game changed. And I think that for many lawmakers, this was no longer just political hardball. You know, this is a game and we're sort of playing the game. I really think that for so many of us, you know, and for these particular, you know, North Carolina representatives and senators, like many of us, just really understand the stakes of what's going on and just how grave this situation is. So, you know, I salute them and you know, really hope that the full delegation takes seriously the significance of this moment and the fact that we're not going to forget how they behaved in it.
Deandra Rose is an assistant professor of public policy and political science at Duke University. And one more footnote, albeit an important one. After the 1898 insurrection in Wilmington, Democrats pushed for a state constitutional amendment, ultimately to disenfranchise black voters. It was on the ballot 2 years later and backed by the Charlotte Observer in editorials. A literacy test was approved and enacted. The results were stark. In 1896, 87% of eligible blacks voted. Just 8 years later, less than 5% of all eligible black voters cast ballots. That's it for today's WUNC Politics podcast. Thank you for listening. Remember, there's an easy way to make sure you never miss an episode. Subscribe. And please come back on Friday for our regular review of the biggest stories of the week. It is still early in the week, so no predictions. I'm Jeff Tabiri. Talk to you soon.